welcome to Be Your Own Healer Telesummit. I'm Jonathan Fitzgordon, your host and founder of Core Walking. Today I'll be talking with Katie Bowman, a scientist of biomechanics who teaches how to reverse disease process through correct alignment and movement. Katie is the founder and director of the Restorative Exercise Institute and the author of two books and numerous DVDs. Her newest book, Alignment Matters, is a collection of posts from 5 years of writing on her blog, Katie Says. Katie and I mine similar territory, and I first learned about her from readers of my own blog. I write a blog at Core Walking, who would write me comments such as, I like what you say, but Katie says, and at moments like that, you can get your back up or be open to other voices, and I would read Katie's post, and I've been a real big fan of hers ever since. Katie's skills as a health scientist, coupled with the unique ability to explain complex concepts, such as using language that is clear, simple, and sometimes hilarious, have made her a sought-after teacher. She teaches how the body works so that any person can make informed and educated decisions when it comes to one's own health. So, Katie, thanks so much for talking to me today. Welcome.
Oh, thanks for having me. Thanks for reading that tremendous bio, too.
Oh, my pleasure. What does the phrase, be your own healer, mean to you, and why is it important for people to help themselves?
I'm a pretty... I'm a pretty black and white person when it comes to definitions. You know, I'm more of a numbers person. So with respect to words, semantically speaking, the person who does the healing is always you, right? If you have a problem with your body, it's a completely internalized process of healing. If you have a scab, your body is the one doing the work. So I think literally, be your own healer is how it works. So that's what it always means to me. Like, I don't see any other way besides how you can be your own healer. I don't know how someone else could do the healing for you or heal you on your behalf. So that's always how I think about it.
That's great. How has your history informed your approach to how you work with people now?
Well, you know, I started right now, almost 15 years later, I'm more of a public, I do my teaching in the public, in the media, to hundreds of thousands of people, but I started just working with individuals one-on-one. I spent probably 8 or 9 years dealing with people one-on-one. So I think initially I would want to help that person. That's how I viewed it. I viewed that my session with you when I was working on your alignment and your corrective exercise and your exercise prescription, that there was a certain amount of work that I was responsible for as your teacher or as your trainer. And in that way, over time, what I realized is there were groups of people who really took more responsibility for themselves. They came to those sessions thinking about, what can I learn from you so that I can go on to do this myself? And then there were individuals who really reviewed our relationship as you fill this hole for me. You provide the motivation, you provide the information, you provide the environment for which I can do that. And over time, what I realized is it was really hard to convert the mindset of the person who was coming, if their mindset was, it was my job to do all of those things. And so as I was growing in terms of popularity, it left me with less time. And so over time, the populations that I chose to work with were those who really did take a lot of personal responsibility and who were using me as a jumping board instead of as someone to basically be their inertia, like to overcome their inertia for them. It takes a lot of energy, as you probably know, as an educator or a trainer or a doctor or whatever your role is, if you are to fulfill everything for another person, those types of relationships aren't usually very sustainable. And so over time, I would say that my more fastidious perspective on it's your responsibility and I'm your teacher has developed out of years of working and seeing the progress of people who did and did not take that perspective. So now I just am 100%, you know, the instructor, and it's your responsibility to do the work.
And what led you to this type of work? Like, I know you studied biomechanics in school, and I really appreciate that about you, that you really do come from a scientific perspective. I read a lot of, you know, bloggers and writers who work in the, who are talking about the same stuff, and I really appreciate that you have a fairly straight-ahead scientific approach to it. So what did it start in school, or was it even, like, what did you want to be when you grew up?
Well, I remember probably from the age of 6 all the way till 15, if someone asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up, I had a list of 4 things, and it never occurred to me that I had to pick one. So the list was always, I want to be an astronaut, a writer, an actor, and a doctor. I kid you not, that was my list. And so far, it seems like I've done 3 kind of out of 4. You know, I've done DVDs, I have books, and I help people with their health. So I'm not literally a medical doctor, and the closest I've come to being an astronaut would be working on astronaut biomechanical contributions of, like, weightlessness stuff. So I've definitely dabbled in a lot, but I've always wanted to do many things. But when I went to school, to answer your question on how I ended up doing what I do now, when I went to school, it was with being a mathematician or getting a degree in math, and then very quickly that changed to physics because I'm more of a problem solver. I like to, like, tangible, like physical world, real world, and math was a little too theoretical for me. And then physics, it turned out, was also a little too theoretical for me. So when I was in college, I was trying to transfer departments, and I found this very small program at the university I was going to called biomechanics. And I had also become, I was pretty bookwormy, I would say. Is that, I don't know if that's an adjective, but up through the bulk of my life. But I discovered exercise, really, when I was about 18 or 19. I started walking because I didn't have a car once I was about 17, when I was a senior in high school. And I found that I would really feel amazing after walking, you know, the few miles to school and walking home. And then I got to the point where after I was done walking to school and back, I would drive a family member's car to the beach, where I would then walk for maybe another 4 or 5 miles. And it really helped me, I would say, metabolize a lot of the stress during that time, you know, teenage stress and the stress of dealing with all those things. And so I started to become a mover, and the biomechanics program is actually falls under kinesiology in the United States. So I got to take all of my math and physics credits and transfer them over, and then got to study all the physiology and anatomy. But I was already coming at physiology and anatomy from a different perspective, because I am by nature more of a mechanical thinker. I tend to think in terms of forces, and so by instead of going anatomy, physiology, and mechanics second, doing it the other way around probably shaped more my interest in how is the body shaped by the forces that were created, by how we move and how we live. And then I went to graduate school again to study biomechanics, at this point specifically to research the effect of structural forces and disease. So it was more studying the body on the, not the molecular level, but maybe the cellular level, where you can still measure forces like compression and tension, seeing cells and tissues being squished or stretched, and what are the physiological responses to those types of loads. And it just took off in my mind and in my work, and it all started with just, I didn't want to do something like physics anymore, and became, you know, my greatest passion.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. It's very interesting, you know, through doing these interviews and just in the, you know, nature of the world I'm in, so many people are coming to this work from a place of their own pain or injury, and it doesn't seem like you come from that. You just come from a scientific curiosity, and I think that actually gives you a very interesting voice in the dialogue.
Yeah, I didn't even think about that, but yeah, I didn't come to alternative healing to fix my own injuries per se, but it might be that maybe on a bigger level, which is just thinking about, I would say that as a child I was always extremely thoughtful in terms of wanting to mitigate the suffering of others. That's been a big theme in my life, even as, you know, a 3- and 4- and 5-year-old. Other people's suffering has always really bothered me. And I would say that while what I do on the surface looks like structural alignment and exercise and fixing your musculoskeletal issues, what my platform really is about, if you pan out a little bit, is how is the human being's suffering tied to the way that we live our life, and how is this particular culture's quantity of suffering related to how many other cultures are suffering? And I, of course, you know, and admitting a total bias, I really see our mechanical environment as being a theme through the questions and the answers to that degree, which is what happens when you have a bunch of people, you know, living in a like a zoo-like habitat for the most part, we humans, and then how do we call on manufactured devices and things that tax other peoples and the ecosystems to offset the result of our choices. And so I don't really, that's more like in my next book, talking about that bigger platform, but I would say it's not just about alignment. It is about healing the soul, you know, if you will, but I would, again, come at it from more of a mechanical, I'm not a big philosopher because I don't like to spend a lot of time on questions that don't have answers, questions that can never be answered. So I like to look for solutions that still have some sort of positive outcome. So that's all I have to say about that.
That's great. Like, do you, I don't know if you care about labels, but like, do you, how do you identify yourself as like a teacher or a healer or a guide?
A teacher. I would say that a teacher is probably my preference. I get a lot of emails and they're like, you fixed me. And I just like to say, I really haven't. And I think that if you keep thinking that I fixed you, then you will have missed the most amazing thing, which is you fixed yourself. And that's what we're trying to help people understand, is there is no, there's no magic pills, there's no magic hands, there's no magic practice. Perhaps the greatest component to what all of us do is that the user has to choose to do it. And there's nothing in terms of scientific investigation that really looks at that choice. The moment you make that choice, what starts happening on a molecular level, and does the mode or the practitioner make as much of an impact as the fact that you have decided?
I think, you know, for me, one of my big things, I work, teach people to walk for pain relief mostly, but also like athletic performance, and I find right or wrong is an interesting process for me, because I'll be working with somebody and they're very much, is this right? Am I doing it wrong? Am I doing it right? And a lot of my thing is it's there is no right or wrong. There's definitely better. There's like, you had an old pattern that you were really married to, and this is what you carried with. And now if we're looking to change your pattern, better is a way of describing it. But people are always looking for me to say right or wrong. And I'm very big on telling people, like, I can't fix you. And what's interesting in terms of hearing you say that is, I think there really are a lot of people in our world who are very invested in the fact, and they do great work, but they're invested in the fact that they are actually laying claim to fixing people.
Well, that's the challenge of trying to, I guess, make a living at,
totally.
at your trade of, I have this information that can make you, that can make you better, or that will make you, or that has made a lot of people feel better. So I think it's okay to cite the improvements that other people have experienced via your program, because that's just, I mean, that's just evidence. It's empirical evidence. But it's, I mean, for the person who's making the claims, I guess you're, I mean, we could be talking about, does a person use that terminology because it's just people are equating, hey, I have this really great information that can make you better, or do they equate themselves as the channel through which your healing must occur. And I have a certification program. So, you know, I teach other people how to teach, you know, basic corrective exercise. But what I try to tell the teachers is your goal is not to, your goal should not be to want someone to come to you indefinitely for education. It's to inspire someone through their own personal experience of getting better that I want to learn this completely so that I can do it myself and pass it on. That's been the relationship of teaching and learning historically, you know, which is just a mentor and a student, and you go through it together. But you are imparting your knowledge so that you share the same knowledge, not holding the information and giving someone small little bits so that they have to indefinitely come back to you to feel your business. And that maybe is the problem with wanting to make a living out of healing versus wanting to make a living out of sharing your information. So if you can keep those two things separate, as a health practitioner, I do believe it opens up. It not only changes, you know, the energy behind what you do, I do think it's a much more attractive mindset, because if you're afraid of someone healing themselves because it might damage your business, then there's already an energetic maybe problem with what you're offering, perhaps.
No, I absolutely agree. I just think there's a huge piece of that we have to empower people to understand that they heal themselves.
Sure. That's why you're doing this, right? Like
that's
your whole motivation.
Yeah. So I know it. You know, you had said that you and people heal themselves, which is a perfect image for me. But do you go to body workers? Do you go to chiropractors and rolfers? Like, do you take on that kind of work for yourself?
I do. Yeah. And I take. I mean, I take all sorts of. I mean, we could put them in a category of healing, but yes, I think that there are skilled practitioners who have more information than I do about what needs to be done. But I guess it's just about how you view the session. You know, I love body work and fascial work, but I would say that for me, my way of interacting in a session is to learn. And I think kind of it might drive some of my body workers insane sometimes, because I was like, explain what you're doing or telling me. And
yeah.
A lot of times they're like, just stop talking, and maybe your desire to know everything is interfering with what's happening. But sometimes that's all I need someone to say, which is part of what can be beneficial about what's happening is if you don't think about it so much. And I don't want to come across like that thinking and breaking things down is the only way to learn. So for me, my whole in learning is learning through experience, where maybe someone else really spends most of their time learning through experience, and their whole might be learning a different, more of like an academic perspective. They might have tons of experiential learning, but maybe they don't have the terminology for it, so communicating it becomes more difficult. Mine is the flip side. So I've had wonderful teachers, and I will put my body workers in the category, and any of my healers, chiropractic and Ayurvedic, and my husband's an Ayurvedic practitioner, and I don't think I've learned as much from anyone else as I have from him. So I certainly partake in, quote, healing modalities, but I would put them also into they're just modalities that teach me lots about other perspectives and how lots of things work that aren't really covered in anything else except just experiencing them.
So, and I think I'm right. So you don't work individually anymore, is that right?
I do sometimes, but when I do, it's just like pro bono, like someone just happens to, I mean, I do as much,
right.
I do most of my work free. That's my personal, I try to live a life of service. So most of what I do of my time is exchanged for free. So if someone happens to catch me, I will definitely do some stuff with them. But right now the demand is so high, you know, if I get a few hundred emails a day, that's a low day. So what I try to do is spend my time creating information that can be consumed by lots of different people. But I do a training. Like I said, I have a certification program. So during a certain portion of that training program, people they observe. And so during that time, I'll work directly with people. But at this point, no. At this point, I found that people don't, in order to learn the content that I'm giving, the bulk, I kind of use it as a filter. You have to do a certain amount of work on your own first before you would even come to need someone like me who can pinpoint lots of more complex things that you on your first day aren't even ready to hear. So that's why it's like you need to read this and you need to be doing these corrective exercises first so that if you do see me or someone else, you're not learning the ABCs, that you've taken enough responsibility to learn the ABCs so that we can have a conversation about sentence structure would be a metaphor for learning these few basic moves so that we can look at the way you're moving larger pieces. So it's a language that most people do not have, and so I have always set up kind of a minimum of language that you should get before coming to do a private session when I do them, which is infrequently.
And in that context, like, so you're working on a physical level, but do you, and this goes for you and even what do you think about other practitioners, like, is recommending, like, let's say diet or lifestyle advice within your purview, do you think that if you're going to work with somebody, you should be basically suggesting all of their needs, or do you just kind of stick to the one thing you do?
Well, when I'm working, I stick to the one thing that I do because, frankly, I don't know anything about anything else. I would say that most people who are experts, the reason you're an expert is because you know a ton about one tiny thing, which due to time constraints that we're all under means I don't know anything about anything else. Now, that all being said, you know, I'm a public figure, so of course people run all sorts of questions by me about lots of other things. And I think they do it because they like the way I think. And when you don't have a very strong background in biology, which I'm just gonna assume that you're talking about mostly health stuff, right? Like diet and meditation and stuff like that. So, like, most people don't have a very large background in biology. They don't have a lot of extra time to learn a bunch of stuff, certainly not to the extent you would to make an educated decision about which diet to follow or which type of therapist. Do I need to see a pelvic floor therapist or should I be looking at my pelvic floor issues? Do I need to see a psychologist or a psychiatrist because I know that there's this emotional component to it? They don't know. It's too overwhelming. And so you're extremely vulnerable, I think, and you look to the person who does one modality for other advice because you trust them. If you're going to them, you trust them, and you're saying, I don't know anything about you know, fascial release, or I don't know anything about biomechanics, or I don't know anything about diet, so I'm going to you and I trust you, but tell me what else I should be doing. Because when someone, we talked about, you know, just before, about when you've decided to get better, usually that person is so motivated, they want to get better in as many different areas as possible, and they want you to just tell them what to do. So I try to resist telling people what to do as much as possible. However, my life's an open book because I am a public figure, and so people will do what I do because they're like, well, you're the person that I'm going to hang my hat on as I'll just trust you and do whatever you say. Throughout history, I would say that experts, and I always like to use Euclid. Euclid is the guy who came up with Euclidean geometry. So pretty much everything that you learned in geometry in high school was created by Euclid. He was a brilliant thinker, and his geometry still stands today. But what most people don't know about Euclid is Euclid had an entire system of living. There were Euclideans, people who just followed everything that he said. And while he was an expert in one particular field, kind of everything else that he said didn't really have anything to do with this genius thing that he came up with. Although it was like he thought in terms of points and lines and the relationship to planes. And he came up with the whole way of living that went along with his geometrical way of seeing something. And so while the geometry stood the test of time, the other things did not. And I think that anytime you're an expert at whatever you're an expert, and everyone is an expert at something, that becomes your filter for how you see the world. And so it makes sense for you to live your life according to your particular genius. And what happens at the test of time might be that the one or two things that you are doing will pull out, but everything else is kind of like, oh, there was someone else who might have had a different perspective where that would have been a little bit different. So, I mean, I understand that that's always going on. Everything that I do and say is going to be tainted by my bias, so I try not to give anything outside of what I feel is my expertise, and of course always going, well, and since it's science, a large portion of my expertise as we go forward is going to be refined, and a lot of what I said will probably turn out to be, you know, not as exact as what we'll know later on. So I think that most people probably don't grasp that information is constantly evolving, and will want one person to tell them everything. But I think as a professional, the more you can refer to other experts, the better. You can certainly have your own range of experts. But I try to stick to biomechanics, knowing, though, that people will always follow other things. I just try to give advice as little as possible, I think.
You know, and teaching people to walk is an interesting process because, for one, nobody thinks they don't know how to walk, most
sure.
people, you know. And in terms of the pain relief work, I'm very often a place of last resort. You know, like they've been to, no one gets a pain and comes to me first. They've gone to a number of doctors, if not yoga teachers, you know, in all different ways, and they're not getting relief. And then they go, okay, maybe this I can do this. But I kind of feel in the same way that you're saying people want fact, it's this sense of people crave permanence, you know. And well, one of the things I'm teaching in this walking program is change, that you can change, that you have a pattern for 40 years. You can change that pattern, but at the same time, I often feel like I'm a cheerleader. You know, I'm believing in these people when they don't believe. How much cheerleading would you say is involved with what you do?
Oh, a ton. I mean, and you're cheerleading, if we put the term cheerleading on it, you know, it seems like, you know, I'm rooting for you, and it's just unbridled enthusiasm because you're just a cheerful, hopeful person. But I would say that probably what you're interpreting as cheerleading would come from a certain amount of confidence in you understand what you're doing more than they do. And so you are cheerleading them to basically say, you know, I know for sure 100% that you can change the way you load your body. It's going to be 100% different than how it was. But you understand that viscerally, and maybe someone else, there's a lot of fear that goes on with, you know, our pain and injury, and we have such poor understanding of our body that we don't even really recognize that the issues that we have are directly, that they're manifesting based on your use patterns. I mean, I hate, and I don't use the word hate very often, but I really do not like the term alternative medicine and just put everything in there besides pills and surgery, because it really implies that this is the stuff to go to when the real solution doesn't work. And that is absolutely not the case. I mean, load science, which you're talking about, which is you have a way of straining your tissues, and that way of straining your tissues, which you've been doing for decades, has peaked the maximum strength. It has created bone spurs. It has thinned. It has thickened different tissues to the point where your biological signal of stop doing that is like you can't even turn it off anymore. And so you know that by, you know, having someone adjust their torso or change their foot position or their stride length or whatever you're doing instantly changes the load to the body. And so the physiology, for the first time, gets a break from that strain that had peaked out. And that person is immediately better. They're immediately better. Now, they define better meaning no more symptoms ever. And you define it as that things are already different and you are on a path to improving. And so there's just a lot of language that gets in the way of helping someone to the process of going. You're saying you have to have faith and just keep going and it'll get better, but really these are all statements that you can make, and you don't, it's not faith that you have, it's experience. And I think that thinking of, I don't think that you're cheerleading really at all. I think that you're just understanding the process so much more. And I think that I do the same, and I do it in the terms of how I just did, which is trying to explain to people that your cells are different right now. They're not the same that they were 1 hour ago or one day or 5 years ago. They're instantly different. If you can just keep up the frequency of doing not good or bad, just different, then you will have a different outcome. And so I just try to stick in the matter of fact of it all and try to stay away from the colorful, because, again, like I said, I'm just so much more black and white in terms of language in that way, but my cheerleading comes from an understanding. I don't think it's just that I'm always in a good mood and I want the best for people. I think it comes from my understanding of how it works. So I just like to clarify that for people, that it's not, I don't think it's just blind, on my behalf, blind enthusiasm for the material. I think it's just, I've spent a lot of time looking at mechanism.
No, I love, you know, there's a confidence piece to it. I love how you said that. So I'll talk to people, and if I teach workshops, and, you know, what I'm saying very often is I think people don't stand well. I stand them the way I want to, and they don't want to believe me. And I say, well, you know, it's my job to think I'm right. Like,
sure.
What would be the point of me being up here and not being absolutely rock solid confident? Now you have to process what you think of that, you know, and that's just, confidence is a beautiful thing in that.
Well, and I think I've made, what has made me successful in my career is through, I don't think people are, I think when you're in pain, you are, I use like checked out. You're just checked, you're checked out. You're not super mindful. And I don't know if there's a really good way of saying which one came first. You know, you could be mindless. You could have checked out because the pain is too much for you to deal with. Or you could be in pain because you've been checked out for a long period of time. There's no really which one came before the other one. But what I try to do is call out sometimes the ridiculousness of statements that people will make. So to use an example that you're probably familiar with, you know, we're both dealing with walking quite a bit, and someone will come in and say, I have this bad knee. So I want to take your walking class so I can walk so it doesn't hurt. And it's like, okay, well, and I'll explain some of the mechanism because I can see right away the loading pattern, and I can see why the ACL was the one to go, and I try to explain. It's like, okay, do you see how when you land this rotation happens and this is a medial moment and that strains? And they're like, well, you know, my doctor said that it's just because of age. And I will always say, I say this a lot, it's like, how old is your other knee that's not bothering you?
Great.
You know, and it's just such a simple, like, oh, so many statements that we make all day long do not even have, they're not even rooted in logic. They're completely illogical. It's the equivalent of a five-year-old trying to convince you that the sky is orange. You know, like I have a two-year-old, and so all the time it's like, do you want this apple? No, I want a red one. This is red. No, it's blue. You know, he's just in the throes of a fit, and it's just crazy things that he's saying. And I think that when we get in pain, we need to make sense of it. And we're too checked out to spend quite a bit of time looking at it logically. So I try to use examples like that help someone break the cycle that they're in of just like running this thing through their mind. It's like, my knee's just bad because it's old. My knee's just bad because it's old. Because how can you as a teacher get them to consider to change the position of their foot in their knee if they are completely committed to it's just old? So I spend a lot of my time, I would say, breaking loops of illogical thought. That's probably my most honed teaching device is through the use of language. And I am a horrible speaker and writer. I am not See, I don't even know what the word is. I'm not linguistical. Like, I'm not a linguist. I am not even that particularly great at grammar and basic English and spelling, but I understand logic very well, and so that has helped me use language, which doesn't require that people see me. You know, I can communicate it in blogs, and that's been really great for people to kind of just break these mantras, and it opens up a whole field of healing that wasn't available to them before, self-healing.
I have to say, I think you're a really good writer in the sense of you're very clear. And one of the things I'm working on in my blog is simple. I'm writing for a lot of yoga teachers, but I'm not intending to. Like, I'm really trying to write for a main audience, and I feel like your stuff is very available to anybody, and a lot of people who do what we do can write just way too technically for their own good and feel the need to get too much muscle or joint in there, and I actually feel like your stuff is very, very clear in an accessible way.
Well, thank you for that, and I don't mean to, I'm not a bad writer, I just mean that, like, writing is not my, it's not a medium that comes easy or natural to me. My husband is a linguist and a copy editor, and so I've learned just as much
right.
about words from him as he's learned about structural integrity from me. We're definitely both two halves of a coin. But yes, I think that in the anatomy world, people are extremely educated in detail, meaning like everyone's had anatomy and everyone can tell you all the names of the muscles and the names of all the different fascia and and where everything attaches, and they know so much terminology, yet the training of understanding forces is almost zero in these populations. And so, like, I'll bring up something about a force and no one knows what I'm talking about, because of course you don't learn forces in any anatomical model. And so the way we learn in the United States and the way we learn, you know, I would say all in all developed places, is that we learn details first and principles second. Our whole entire education system is set up on memorizing a ton of detail, and there's not really a big picture that it ever really integrates back into. So we don't really think about how things work as much as what things are called. And so when I read health pieces, it just tends to be heavy on academic detail and light on, I don't know what the word would be, just light on forces. It's forces. It's always a model that doesn't contain forces. So I've kind of made it a point to try to start teaching the forces. But how do you teach forces to someone who, you know, has no math background or very little physical science background? So I try to use simple models. And yes, it's simple, and it's, I believe someone called it breezy.
Great.
Meaning, like, you know, breezy, and I don't think they meant it in a good way, but this is how information has to be presented at first. You learn the principles first, and if you're interested in understanding more, then you look to the details. But to look for details before you have a concept to which you're trying to integrate them, this leads you of kind of putting together your own picture of details.
That's really great. The one of the main things I'm looking for with people is I think we used to learn anatomy, or like on a math, people used to get some anatomy education, but now there's just absolutely none. And a lot of my walking is, I say, look, if I tell you that your foot is supposed to land a certain way and your knee is supposed to land a certain way over it in relation to your hip, if you know that, you're much more likely to do it better. So for me, there's a huge education piece to, I want to teach people anatomy because it'll make it so much easier for them to help to heal themselves.
Yeah, how could you, I mean, if you can't even visualize the stuff that you're made up of, how can you put your intention there? You know, there's just something so beautiful about understanding yourself more. But it's, you know, it's self-reflection on the most fundamental level. You know, these are your parts in our school system. We break down sentences and we break down our checkbook, but it doesn't really seem to inspire anyone to think that we should be we should be observing ourselves in that way. We all go on to adults and, you know, suffer so much and only to come to some conclusion at some point that we should have been a little bit more introspective and, you know thyself, but it hasn't really made it into the curriculum yet. So what we're all doing is creating, you know, a curriculum of sorts of knowing, being more mindful in so many different ways. Moving is the medium in which, you know, we're all working, but that's what it is. It's mindfulness and it's self-awareness.
To get back to, you know, pain, does healing have to be painful? I mean, or is there a value to pain?
Oh, that's a good question. Does healing have to be painful? Well, I mean, I think pain's pretty subjective. I'm a Vipassana meditator, and so the way we refer to pain is more like sensation. I don't think of sensation to be equal with pain, yet I understand what you're asking. I don't know. I mean, I don't know the answer to that question, if it has to be. I try to quantify getting better in terms of effort. I would say that most people are thwarted from getting better because it's going to take too much work. And so if we talk about pain, you know, if you go to your walking class and they walk and they'll say, oh, you know, Jonathan, I was so sore the next day. So that could be put into a pain category. But my way of understanding the world, I kind of use like a karmic way of understanding the world, which is you are going to do a sum total of work while you're here. And you're going to have a sum total of discomfort while you're here. So you can either take your discomfort in terms of I did this walking class and the change that it caused in my tissues gave me a certain amount of discomfort, and you can do this over and over and over again in different ways, or you can take your pain all in one lump sum, which is for 4 years I've been sitting here and not moving and on pain medication and I need a surgery. So I don't think that necessarily you're going to reduce your physical experience of the world, but I think that through your behavior you can dictate the quantities in which it comes, and then when it comes with that, with a mental component of, I chose to take your class, dealing with the, quote, pain that taking your class caused in my, you know, quadricep, my medial quadricep that I never felt before, is much different chemically than me sitting on my couch wondering, you know, why me? Why did I get this bad genetic knee that's going badly and it's all happening to me, and there's like a whole amount of victim suffering that I think that you can choose to not go through by how much you want to work in smaller pieces, if that makes sense. I don't even know if I just answered your question right now. I think I just talked a lot, but hopefully I did.
No, I think you did. The pain piece is such a trip, and then I think it also comes back to, it's again, self-awareness and the like what you said about different kinds of pain. It's a matter of how much they're willing to look inside about what it is they're processing and experiencing. I think this the answer is probably obvious in relation to what you said, you know, about the woman and who comes in with her knee. But I feel like the essence of what I do, the favorite thing of what I'm doing, is I'm a detective. You know, someone shows up with this pain that they haven't been able to figure out, and all I want to do is help them figure that out, in terms of, sometimes it's about, you know, it could be an illness they had when they were younger and in bed for too long, or a car accident from way back when. How much of what you do is detective work?
Well, I actually have a different approach, because I don't think that you can ever really say that what someone is having is equal to a single event, because your body is a canvas. It's an autobiography that you're always creating through the way you move, and that includes accidents, but it also includes everything else that you've done. And I think that people really want to pinpoint something, because they would feel better knowing that it comes from something that's not happening now, that happened a long time ago, that is not directly correlated to the behaviors that you have. So I would say earlier on, I spent a lot of time trying to help people walk back. I mean, I've had people come in who've forgotten things like, oh, yeah, I forgot that I was in these braces, or, oh, I forgot that I had that surgery. I mean, it's amazing. I had someone who forgot they had open heart surgery. I mean, that's how great the human mind is at moving on, you know. It's like, I'm done with that information isn't serving me, and I'm going forward. So I think that there's a certain amount of detective work to help people understand these or recall these main events, because sometimes a lot of how you move was a direct command that someone gave you. I mean, I'm sure you've worked with a lot of people who said, well, I was told to walk with my toes in, or I was told to walk with my toes out. Or I had one woman who was, she was 96, so she grew up a long time ago, and she was a very kind of a go-getter, kind of an early feminist, you know, if you will, and she wore jeans. She was a total tomboy, and that did not work in the 20s and the 30s. And so her mom would sew her skirts, because she had a long stride, big arm and big leg movements, and she was tall, and her mom said that wasn't ladylike. And so she started sewing her skirts that only allowed her a stride of 6 inches.
Wow.
And so, you know, she shows up in your class, and she's got this stride, and you're going, you know, where did that come from? How is it possible that if someone who's 6 foot tall and has 4 foot long legs is taking 6 inch steps? It might be so ingrained in her reality that she has been casted. She has forgotten the early 15 years in which she was casted. And sometimes just you doing that detective work brings it up and allows her to more consciously kind of release something that's setting the pattern. If you can't recollect something that's setting your pattern, how can you stop? Because so much of us is somatic. Even though it's super deep in our computer, you're still choosing to take the small stride, kind of like in the way that a horse that's been broken hasn't forgotten how to be wild. It just has been so beaten down by the bit being pulled back in its mouth that it no longer acts outside of this box that you've set. So the mind is really good at adapting to the environment and then never going back to revisit it. So sometimes if you bring those up in your detective work, that could be really helpful. So that would be the extent to which I use detective work.
Yeah, that's great. You know, and there's a standard Western model that sometimes doesn't include awareness of other healing modalities. What is your relationship to allopathic medicine in your practice and in your life?
Well, I love allopathic medicine. I mean, I love perspectives. I love multiple perspectives. And what's really interesting to me from a scientific perspective is, in science, you don't eliminate anything until it's been really investigated. And I would say what's happening now is a lot of times medicine is confused with science, in that if it's not medicine, it is not medicine, you know, I guess. And and so for part of, I mean, I have all the allopathic training, so that, I guess that's, I kind of feel like I translate between both worlds, because I do have that whole allopathic, you know, academic background, and at the same time, I work with and understand kind of the language coming from the other side. So I think a lot of times the opposition between the two is more about language and not speaking each other's language. I would say that allopathic medicine is, you want medicine when something is critical. And I think that medicine originally was, it's like an emergency response system. It's the point at which your issue, all the flags have been thrown, the signals have been going off for years, and now you have this problem. Medicine is usually the toolbox that will get you the type of results that you want. However, more things are being put into the medicine, more things are being put into the needs medicine category that may or may not need to be there. And I think that might be less of a function of the allopathic community and more a function of the insurance one, because people want someone else to pay. People want, they don't want to have to pay for, would be one level of a treatment. So they only want to go to the treatments that someone else will pay for, because they've paid their insurance. And in that way, the insurance then gets to dictate who you get to see. And then there's the other person, and they may not be the same person, who just doesn't want to do work. They're not interested in breaking down the work it takes to get better, and so they want the thing that will make them feel better, even if it's a short term, even if they have to go back for something else or something different. And so those populations have kind of driven, I think, the model. But I don't have a problem with medicine. I have many lovely friends that are within that population. I just think that medicine has been given this role. I don't even know if they're the ones taking it, of healing people, and that's not what they do. It's medicine, and that's right. I guess that's something like in terms of language. I really don't like alternative medicine because there is no alternative medicine. There's just medicine. There's medicine or there's not, and we are not medicine. And I think in trying to define what it is that we do so that people will understand, it's a lot easier if you say alternative medicine. It's like, oh, you make people feel better so they don't have to go to the doctor. But that's not, like, food is not medicine. Movement is not medicine. We use those terms because it's, you know, it's like a commercial kind of, right? You know, it's like, don't have to take medicine, you can just eat better. You don't have to take medicine, you can just move better. But when we choose to say movement is medicine or food is medicine, then we put ourselves at odds with a different modality that is medicine, that is some sort of chemical tablet that alters your physiology without you doing anything, or there is a surgery that alters your physiology without you doing anything. So medicine is kind of the search for healing without us having to change the very behaviors that led us to need medicine in the first place. So I would like to create a new term. I don't know what that term is, and it's not my job to create terms, but that's how I have actually just changed my thinking. And I think if we collectively change our thinking, that we'll probably have less an adversarial relationship, or I don't particularly feel like I have one, but if people feel like what their practice is, I assume that a lot of people listening are also going to be, you know, health practitioners who right. are of the non-medical nature, that they can see that changing their thinking helps, but also that one of the reasons medicine, I think probably medicine worked really well initially, and then has just tried to, you know, take over everything. It's kind of like Amazon. It used to be about books, and now it's about every single thing in the world.
Right.
You can get it from Amazon. Anytime you start to want to cover everyone else's territory, anytime that you feel that you have the sole right to be the portal through which people can go through to get better, when you start having political organizations saying who can tell people what types of things that they should be eating or the types of exercises they should be doing, that comes from a protective mentality. You know, you're trying to protect a population, but once you get that large, there's nothing to protect the population from the personal or the political motivations of the said organization. And so it's just it's a big, big political mess, but I think it can be solved by just going back and teaching basic biology and saying that there's a difference between optimizing your biology and taking care of a disease. Those are two different categories, and I choose to work in optimizing your physiology, and I don't deal with diagnosing or fixing people's diseases. That's for medicine. But for me, what I can tell you is what the physiology should be doing, and what are some of the habits that you have, movement otherwise, that lead you to the issues that you're having so that you can stop should you choose to do so.
That's just so great. Thank you so much, Katie. It's been a real pleasure talking to you and learning more about what you do and your perspective on healing.
Well, thanks, Jonathan. I really appreciate what you're doing, too.
Oh, thanks so much. For more info on Katie Bowman, check out her amazing offerings and blog through her website at restorativeexercise.com. This is Jonathan Gordon of corewalking.com and host of Be Your Own Healer Telesummit, wishing you a great day.